John Ronson is one of the most interesting people alive today, period, full stop. He's the author of The Men Who Stare at Goats, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and The Psychopath Test, which spent 10 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. His two TED Talks have been watched 20 million times, his books have been brought to life by George Clooney on the big screen, he's written screenplays for Netflix, blah, blah, blah. Don't believe me? Well, listen to this pitch John wrote for The Psychopath Test. If you are not dying to hear what happens next, then I don't know what to tell you.
This story is about the Scientologists. It's about the crack team of Scientologists who are dedicated to destroying the industry of psychiatry. They think psychiatrists are the most evil people in the world. Anyway, I had lunch with one of them and he told me about a guy named Tony. He said Tony had beaten a guy up 13 years ago. And had subsequently faked madness to get into mental hospital. He thought it would be cushier than a few years in prison, but to his horror, they believed him too much, and they sent him to Broadmoor, which is Britain's most notorious asylum for the criminally insane. He's surrounded by serial killers, he's totally sane, and no one will believe him. And this was like 15 years ago. So I went to visit Tony. All the other Broadmoor patients had given up and were overweight and wearing sweatpants, but Tony came to meet me in a pinstripe suit like a young businessman. So, is Tony telling the truth and he's trapped like a real-life Jack Nicholson in One from Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or is he a psychopath and the Scientologists are petitioning to get a psychopath released? Let me know if this interests you.
All right, John. So I was wondering if we could start with your story, and to give it a particular steer, I'd love to hear your early experiences from childhood and how you've sort of ended up in what I would describe as just a dream career where you just kind of follow your curiosity and produce interesting bits seemingly whenever you feel like it. I mean, how did you end up at that stage?
God, well, it is a dream career. And I worry for people starting out right now. Here's a big tangent. I don't think it'll be worth going down. But, you know, but when I was starting out, I needed to convince gatekeepers who tended to be like Oxbridge type people. And I came from, you know, lower middle class Cardiff suburbs. And there was a little bit of prejudice, I would say, looking back. There was a little bit, you know, my dad ran a warehouse. My mum was a social worker. We lived in Cardiff. I went to, well, where it started to go right was when I was like 16, 17, my mother forced me to volunteer at the local radio station in Cardiff, which was called CBC at the time. And because of that, I got a place in a pretty prestigious journalism course at what was then called the Polytechnic of Central London. So that was like a foot in the door. You know, people took that particular course seriously. And yeah, that, as far as I know, I don't know. I think they like cast it each year because there was like 2000. Like, I remember the figure I was told was like, you'll never get into this course. It's 2000 people apply for 30 places. It's incredibly competitive. But I did get in. And I think the reason why I got in was because they saw me as a bit of a, I think they cast it each year. Like the year above me, there was somebody who was just like me, like, like nerdy and awkward and a little bit like unprofessional and shambolic. And I think they sort of looked for one of those people each year. And the fact that I'd been volunteering at the radio station meant that, you know, I had some gumption. But it was, so that's sort of how I got, you know, my first, you know, just from Cardiff suburbia into something approaching the media. I was just doing that course. And then I started writing for the college newspaper, which was called McGarrell. And I was good at it. Like, it was the first time in my life I'd found something that I was any good at. And my college lecturer told me that. So I started sending off things to magazines. While I was still at college, when I was 18, 19, I sent off stuff to Smash Hits, which was a kind of teenage music magazine at the time. And in fact, Chris Heath, who's gone on to have an incredible career, writing some brilliant books, was an editor there. And he gave me like a chance to write some film reviews and stuff. And then I used those film reviews to hustle my way into other places like The Guardian and The Sunday Correspondent. And yeah, so that's how it happened. But to circle back to the beginning, I needed, you know, there weren't that many platforms, and I needed to convince gatekeepers to give me access to those platforms. That's not the case anymore. You could have a very good career with no gatekeepers at all. That's what YouTube's all about. And I think it's good and it's bad. Like, on the one hand, I hated having to, like, you know, humble myself to people who were a little bit prejudiced towards me, not Chris Heath and Smash Hits, but other places. At the time, there were certain people at The Guardian, I think, who thought I was like a toe rag because I didn't go to one of the good universities. So that's all been eliminated. But at the same time, it's probably harder to get noticed now than it was. Like, if you do make it through people's, you know, into people's gardens, then you get noticed. Now you don't need permission, but it's harder to get noticed, maybe.
In terms of getting through those gatekeepers, was it, you know, to quote Cal Newport, was it be so good they can't ignore you? Was it about being prolific? How did it end up working out for you?
The honest truth, and I hope this doesn't sound like egotistical, was that it was when I was at The Guardian, I've never really talked about this before, but at the very early days when I was at The Guardian, they kind of wanted to get rid of me. Like, they didn't think I was any good and they wanted to get rid of me. Not everyone, like Kath Viner, who's the editor now, was always a big champion of mine, thank God, because she was always an important, like, voice at The Guardian. And she's the editor now. But other people just thought I was crap and didn't want me. And the reason why I stayed was because the readers liked me. It was the fact that the readers liked me. Reader feedback was really positive about me. And so they couldn't get rid of me for that reason. They would have otherwise.
It sounds like in your career track, it's been quite important to get into major publications or get the approval of these gatekeepers. And now it seems there's a shift where you can actually just put content or media out yourself without any of that. If you were sort of starting today, do you think you'd be going down a track where you're like, look, I'm younger, I need to prove myself, I should get a stamp of approval from someone, so then that opens up more doors for me? Or do you think you'd be going down this whole, like, Substack podcasting independent creator type of track?
It's a really good question. I think when I was younger, I don't know what I would have done because I was more tireless and could produce a lot of stuff. Like, I was writing weekly columns. I could never go down that Substack route now simply because I'm slow. I'm a slow, slow worker. I sort of see myself as like a kind of dollhouse maker. Like, I intricately work away on minutiae very slowly. And people don't want that if they're subscribing to you on Substack or, you know, on a podcast feed. They want constant content. So I couldn't. So now I think I need to be in the old, like, legacy media for that reason. I wish it wasn't the case, to be honest. I wish I was the sort of person who could produce three shows a week, three podcasts a week, or, you know, several Substacks a week. I think, A, you can make more money that way. And B, you know, I like it as a fan. Like, if I'm subscribing to a podcast, I don't want eight episodes a year. I want two episodes a week. So I see that is what people want, but unfortunately it just doesn't match the way that I am now. Back then, maybe I would have been more tireless and I could have done that.
It reminds me of this document. I think it's called Das Slow Media Manifesto, but it's a movement towards building slow media, things that take a long time to consume that are thoughtfully made. And that kind of reminds me of what you've done, essentially. But I wanted to ask, are there times where you've spent a lot of time kind of in your metaphorical cave writing, making something, and it's just come out and it's just bombed? Like, no one liked it.
No one cares. Yes, I'd say. you can never anticipate. I was actually thinking about this the other day. Like, pretty much every story I do, it takes place with me down a rabbit hole, very enthusiastically searching around and, you know, constructing a story and getting, like, super obsessively enthusiastic about whatever particular subject it is. And then I emerge, you know, with like a big sort of smile saying, you know, look at this, you know, that's the psychopath test, or that's, so you've been publicly shamed, or, you know, an episode of Things Fell Apart, or whatever. But very often it's not, you know, I think it's all great. Like by the time I'm back out of the rabbit hole, I feel like, okay, I've found the best possible way of telling the story. And I was so, you know, excited and enthusiastic when I was down the rabbit hole. I'm sure you will be too. And sometimes they are and sometimes they're not, frankly. Like, and it's really hard to predict. The psychopath test, I had to do almost like no work to convince people to read that book. Like it was like a dream. I sat at home watching TV and people were like buying the book. That rarely happens. Most of the time you have to hustle. In the same way you have to hustle and hustle to get the story told, you also have to hustle and hustle to get people to be interested in it. And, you know, and quite often they're not. There's many... The first episode of season one of Things Fell Apart is about the origins of the abortion culture wars. And it's the most incredible story. Like, we ferreted out the story of this teenage kid in the Swiss Alps in the 1970s, dreaming of being a Hollywood director, and his ambition to make it in Hollywood directly led decades later to abortion doctors being murdered. It's an incredible twisty-turny path from one thing to the other. And I thought that story would go like insane because it's such an insane story. And that one kind of didn't. It did a bit, but not as much as I thought. You really can't tell. You can't tell. Like sometimes you'll bring something out and it catches fire. Other times it just doesn't. And in the end, you know, your job is to make the best story possible and then let the fates decide, I guess.
I want to ask you about the post-mortem process for a project that might not have gone as well as you expected. And if we could zoom in specifically on how you think about analytics, there's a really good book that I read recently called The Art and Business of Writing Online. And that's by someone who basically got his craft from just going on Quora and answering questions. He would answer a question every day and eventually became one of the top writers. And
isn't that how Jordan Peterson started out?
Is it rightly?
it was either Quora or Reddit. And I think it was Quora, exactly the same thing. Back in the days when Jordan Peterson, I thought, was interesting. I thought 12 Rules for Life was a good book. You know, he obviously, like so many people, he spiraled off subsequently. But yeah, anyway, go on. I didn't want to interrupt.
No, people like them, they attribute a lot of their writing success to getting that immediate tight feedback loop of feedback. You get upvotes or whatever metric it is. You are putting your writing out and every day you've got a feedback loop. Whereas someone like yourself, it might be a year long or a 6 month long feedback loop on your projects. So just to ask you in terms of how you think about those postmortems of projects that haven't gone as well and how much mind you pay to analytics.
I got to say, I really love these kind of in the weed questions. so thank you for asking such sort of interesting, stimulating questions. Analytics, I never look at, just never. I don't think I ever have. However, there is a version of that that I did one time. When I was writing the psychopath test, I went on a psychopath spotting course. Like I learned how to spot psychopaths on a course in a marquee in West Wales. And I remember so clearly on the train, Twitter, this must have been like 2010. So it was really the early days of Twitter, maybe in 2009. And I was on the train going back to London and I tweeted, you know, I've just been on a psychopath spotting course for my next book. Does anyone have any questions? And the entire journey, I was getting question after question after question. I was thinking, whoa, this is really going. People are really interested in psychopaths. This is going well. So I guess that's my version of like sort of instant, you know, just like you said about people going on Quora. And that certainly put the wind behind my sails, thinking people really want to know about this stuff. But most of the time I don't do that. Most of the time I'm very secretive. And I don't quite know why I've become so secretive. I'm sure there's like an element of paranoia involved that, you know, will somebody scoop me? And which has nearly happened once in a while. When I made The Last Days of August, I was almost scooped. Like somebody got hold of a review copy, an embargoed review copy, and basically spilled the whole thing in their magazine. And I found out the night before and phoned up the editor and like begged them not to publish it. Like I was saying, it was like, you know, like I'm being stolen from. And they didn't publish it. So that paranoia can be justified sometimes, but I think it is basically just paranoia. Like I don't want to, well, it's not just paranoia. On the one hand, I don't want to tell people what I'm working on because I don't want them to steal the idea. And but there is another reason, which is that if I told you like what my next book's about now, I would be staring at you, looking for any flinch of disappointment in your face that you can't control. And it would just, yeah.
John, I'll give you the golden retriever energy. I'll be nodding my head like, amazing job.
I would still be staring, just looking for those little subconscious flickers of, that doesn't sound like a very good book. And I think that would be enough. You know, I sent a chapter of my new book to my editor the other day, and he sent it back saying, you know, this is so great. You know, it's so fantastic to see your, you know, style on the page again after it's been a few years. And that was really good editing, because at this sort of early fragile stage, you know, if somebody says the wrong thing, it could really knock you off course. So I find that I just want to internalize it all in case that happens.
Let me apply the startup lens to make a comment and then also ask you a question about your creative process, because when you described sending a tweet out about the psychopath spotting course, that was effectively an MVP, a minimum viable product that you sent out, and you immediately got customer validation that, you know, I should go ahead and build this, which is quite interesting. I guess my question to you is, in the startup world, the common thread is that an idea is basically meaningless. It doesn't have any intrinsic value. And what matters is your execution. But from what you're saying, it sounds like in the publishing world, or in the, you know, creative nonfiction writing world, that ideas actually have a huge value, and someone can actually literally take your idea and basically build a very compelling product from that. Is that right? That in your world, ideas actually matter a lot, and it's not just execution?
I think it's a bit of both. I think if somebody who's in the same kind of genre as you, somebody who's really similar to you, is doing a really similar idea, that can cause trouble. I remember having a Christmas party when I was writing the psychopath test, and Louis Theroux came to it, and he said, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "I'm writing a book about psychopaths." And I said to him, I felt like this huge, you know, sort of bolt of nerves, and I said, please don't do anything about psychopaths for the next 6 months till my book comes out. So I think if that would have been a disaster, but ultimately I think the execution is the most important thing. It is, like, sometimes, many times I've heard that there's another book coming along that's similar to mine. That happened with So You've Been Publicly Shamed. There was a book coming along called Is Shame Necessary, which was going to be published at the same time. And I was a bit worried about that. But ultimately, it is the execution, which is a good reason to be kind of idiosyncratic, to not... if you're, you know, off on your own journey, you know, ploughing your own furrow, is that the expression? Then... even if somebody does come out with a book that's very similar in subject matter, it quite often doesn't matter. You know, if your book is well written and a page turner and idiosyncratic and it's very you, I think it doesn't matter. I think ultimately the execution matters more.
I want to get your take on some Tim Ferriss writing advice. And he basically says that if you're struggling to write something good, you need to just go out and do interesting stuff. That's the antidote to that. It's not that you need to learn more writing techniques or study great writers. Just go out and do interesting stuff, and you'll immediately remedy that situation. And I just wanted to get your take on that piece of advice, because when I read it, I thought back to a lot of experiences I've had. I've worked in psychiatry. I've worked in, you know, the accident and emergency department. And I've had a lot of interesting experiences, but I've not really got any. I've got like two good stories. That's it. So I'm not immediately convinced by that advice. But what's your take?
So it's an interesting question. It reminds me of, you know, I always remember Woody Allen saying that if he runs out of inspiration, he just goes into another room, which is a sort of version of that. And I find that, like, if I'm getting cabin fever and I'll go for like a big long hike, a couple of times during that hike, I'll email myself with an idea that's popped into my head. It could be for, at the moment, I'm doing a psychopath night at the end of this year, at the end of 2024. I'm doing like 20 psychopath shows. And the other day I was hiking and a couple of ideas for that popped into my head. So I emailed them to myself. So that's a sort of version of what Tim Ferriss said. But instead of going off and getting another job, it basically is go off to a different environment, go for a walk, go to a different room. I'd say that works. Excuse me. But I've never had another job, so I don't know. Like, I've only ever been a writer.
Yeah, no, in terms of writing, say, the psychopath test, when you hit points, like writer's block, would your natural reaction be, because what you've described there is like a change of scenery, right? But might your reaction be, actually, I need to just go out and do more research. I need to go spend some more time in Broadmoor or some other sort of facility. And that's how I'll become interesting, not necessarily from the actual execution of the writing. It's more from the inspiration and ideation stage and experiential stage. Like, what's your thought on that?
Right. Well, it's one of my favorite parts of the process to, you know, if I'm suddenly in a, you know, I'm down a rabbit hole and I found something, you know, with the psychopath test. So I thought, you know, the brainwave was, I'm going to go on a psychopath spotting course, and then I'm going to journey into the corridors of power to see if I can spot any psychopaths, in, you know, in high places, in boardrooms or whatever. And I thought, that's a real brainwave. And that could lead me to so many other areas, like, you know, who runs the psychopath spotting course? Are there competing courses? If so, do the course leaders all hate each other? And the answer is probably yes, because they're academics and academics hate each other. And, you know, is it fair? Is it ethical to do this? Maybe I should meet a critic of psychiatry to, you know, tell me that it's not ethical to armchair diagnose people as psychopaths. You know, question after question after question. And each one of those questions can potentially take you to a whole new area. And, you know, you go down a bunch of those roads and you'll just think, yeah, you know, that's not so interesting. But maybe one or two of those roads will take you to a whole other chapter, which you never anticipated. So that just like being just a twig in the river of the story. Well, no, that makes it sound like you're passive, and you're not passive. You're actively thinking, okay, could I go down this road? Could I go down that road? It's a hugely important. I mean, I'm doing it at the moment. I won't tell you what the thing is, but but it's taken me to the Boer War, which is something I know nothing about. Like, I presume there was some South Africa involved. That's like all I know. But one thing I'm going to do over the next couple of days is go down a little rabbit hole about the Boer War. And maybe it will give me a paragraph or maybe it won't, but it'll be like a fun, you know, fun thing to go down.
I want to ask you about another Tim Ferriss concept, and it's about your relationship with fame. He wrote this really amazing article on how fame has changed his life and the ugly side of it as well. And he gives loads of examples of how, you know, that eventually you need to be careful when you're landing in a new country that someone's not there to abduct you. You know, when the driver arrives at the airport and they have your name on it, if you're rich and famous, people will come there. They'll have your name on and they'll kind of abduct you.
Shit. Well, luckily I always get the Heathrow Express. So
I think you meant on not the UK side, on the
right.
Maybe some more wild locations. But the conclusion of that article was essentially that it's better to be anonymous and wealthy and successful. Mm. So basically people know your name, but they don't know your face and be that kind of prolific, rather than be someone whose face is plastered everywhere. And when I like study your trajectory, and feel free to correct me on this, but it seems like early on you were more prolific for being an author, and maybe you had that kind of fame where people know John Ronson, but they wouldn't recognize you on the tube. And now, very much to me, it seems like you've hit a point of fame where people actually recognize you, and you have quite a distinctive kind of character and look to you that people will pick up. And I just wanted to ask you, like, why? Like, that looks to me like to be the worst part of fame, that, you know, people know your face now.
Well, it's never bad. I remember I used to be good friends with Zoe Ball when she was, you know, insanely famous, like, you know, presenting The Big Breakfast on, you know, she was like a, you know, I mean, she still is, but in the 90s, she was like, you know, practically kind of Kate Moss level fame. And I remember her saying to me, you have the perfect level of fame. Like, it's just enough that it sort of massages your ego. But, you know, but she said, I've got people hiding in my bushes, like waiting for me to leave the house. And she said she like envied my level of fame. It was just enough. And I think, you know, my whole life, that's been the case. Like, if I come back to England, if I, you know, in America, I don't get spotted very often. And I actually don't go out very often. I'm not a party person. I basically stay home and work and then go for a hike and then or run and then watch TV. So, you know, so most of the time I'm either alone or with my wife or wife and son. In Britain, when I come back to Britain, I guess I'm, you know, I'm recognized maybe once or twice a day. Someone will come up to me. And that's just, that's a perfectly pleasant amount of, you know, times. Like, it's, I've never felt, well, once in a while. Okay, so I, not long ago, I had a little bit of a strop about something in public, forgetting that anybody would know who I am. And somebody said at the end of my strop, like, looked really disappointed and said, I'm a fan of yours. And so I suppose if I'm, you know, if I have a little meltdown or a strop about something, that's the downside of being well known. You can't just anonymously do it and nobody knows it's you.
You can't have a bad day.
You can't really have a bad day. That's the one downside. But otherwise, no, it's great. It's never, it's only ever been just enough to massage my ego a little bit and never anything that impedes me in any way.
Okay, so you might be teetering on the edge of that level of fame, though. Maybe if you got a little bit more famous, you might hit that level, no?
Maybe. Then again, here in upstate New York, you know, the chance of anyone being impressed by me is pretty slim. So even if I go back to Britain, it's fine. It's not something I worry about. I remember I'm friends with Robbie Williams and... And I was at a restaurant with him one night, and Stephen Fry was there, and he sort of was sitting with us, and I don't know, he's the only time I've ever met him, but a couple of, you know, women went up to him and told him what a big fan they were, and afterwards I said to him, you know, does that ever get annoying? And he said, oh, something like, you know, nothing like that. I mean, that was just delightful. And that's kind of what I feel too. Like, if somebody comes up to me and, you know, says they like my work, I, you know, 99 times out of 100, I just think it's delightful. And it doesn't, it's not like you're, you know, walking around on cloud nine for the rest of the day. Like, the feeling diminishes almost immediately and you go back to your usual, you know, worried, anxious self. But it's never a problem. It's never been a problem.
John, I was wondering if you could read your pitch for the psychopath test. Yes. And the reason for that is because I think it's sort of one of the most interesting few hundred words that I've ever heard. And I'd love to dissect it a little, but love for you to read it first.
Sure, absolutely. So I pitched this to This American Life. And the reason why you know about this is because, you know, when I gave those writing workshops, I read this out as a good pitch. And I know it was a good pitch because Ira Glass put it on to This American Life's website as a perfect pitch that should be emulated. Okay, here we go. This story is about the Scientologists. It's about the crack team of Scientologists who are dedicated to destroying the industry of psychiatry. They think psychiatrists are the most evil people in the world. Anyway, I had lunch with one of them and he told me about a guy named Tony. He said Tony had beaten a guy up 13 years ago and had subsequently faked madness to get into mental hospital. He thought it would be cushier than a few years in prison, but to his horror, they believed him too much, and they sent him to Broadmoor, which is Britain's most notorious asylum for the criminally insane. That last line, maybe I over-egged it a little bit. He's surrounded by serial killers, he's totally sane, and no one will believe him. And this was like 15 years ago. So I went to visit Tony. All the other Broadmoor patients had given up and were overweight and wearing sweatpants, but Tony came to meet me in a pinstripe suit like a young businessman. So, is Tony telling the truth and he's trapped like a real-life Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or is he a psychopath and the Scientologists are petitioning to get a psychopath released? Let me know if this interests you. So there you go. That was the pitch.
Wait, so,
which I could tell, by the way, from reading it back, that I wrote that in 10 minutes. Like, this wasn't something I agonized over.
So, yeah. So what's, if we have to dissect maybe three or four things about it or techniques, like, why is it so interesting?
I tell you, reading it back just now, what I kind of liked is that I start off by saying this story is about the Scientologists. But it's not about the Scientologists at all. It's about Tony and Broadmoor. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Funnily enough, the other night I was at a party upstate and somebody came up to me who had read the psychopath test and was talking about the Scientologists. And I said to them, one thing I like about the psychopath test is that other people would have written a book entirely about the Scientologists. But my sort of Scientology section of that book is, you know, it's a few pages. It's like I'm packing a whole bunch of books into one book. It's like I'm giving people five books for the price of one. And so I think there's that this story is dense. You know, it's sort of packed with really interesting things that I'm not dwelling on. Like, I'm not dwelling on the fact that it's about the Scientologists and they've got a crack team who want to destroy the industry of psychiatry. But most of all, I think the reason why it's interesting, obviously, is because of Tony. There's a central mystery to it. And it's an extraordinary mystery. You know, there's a real-life Jack Nicholson from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's trapped at Broadmoor and nobody will believe he's sane. That's immediately a kind of intriguing, mysterious, funny, absurd story about a really unexpected, dark, important thing. So there's dissonance there, but, you know, a dissonance between the comedy and the horror, the silliness and the intrigue. I think all of that really works. It's got a sort of Kurt Vonnegutness about it. In fact, I could read what Ira Glass wrote about the pitch underneath.
Please.
This is what he said about my story. He said, it's a story in the most traditional sense. There are characters in some situation and a conflict. Also, the story raises some bigger question or issue, some universal thing to think about. Because that's exactly what I said. Ira said that too. Also, I told the story as if I was telling it to a friend in a pub. And I've noticed that over and over again. Like if you're, because there's the story, and then completely separate to the story is the way you tell the story to people. And that becomes part of the process every time, because at some point you have to like introduce this story to the world. You have to say, this is what my next book's about. And that's a whole different thing to writing the book. So Ira says, and I completely agree, that a really good way of telling the story to someone is the way you would tell it to somebody if you were just having a coffee with them. My friend Maeve Higgins, when I made the show The Debutante last year for Audible, my friend Maeve Higgins said, what's it about? And I kind of heard myself say, it's the story of a Tulsa debutante who, as a result of a series of unlikely and often very bad life choices, found herself in the midst of one of the most terrible crimes ever to happen in America. And I thought, whoa, that's a great way of telling the story. And so I made that the first line of The Debutante, and only because it just came out when I was talking in a relaxed way to my friend Maeve about it.
So at a high level, there's this piece of having some sort of central mystery and unusual idea. And then on a more granular level, one thing I noticed was that like the tempo of the storytelling is very It's very irregular. It's very erratic. It's very unpredictable. There's not only the high rate of revelation, which you've described, where it's like multiple books packed into a few lines, but also the story, the beats are just unpredictable at each step. Do you think that's part of it?
Yes, I think so. It partly comes from sort of paranoia that I don't want to write a book that anybody else could possibly think of. So, you know, you really want to, you know, go off on your own. And I think there is a certain level of confidence to that too. And it's not a confidence I have in fiction or screenwriting or whatever, only nonfiction, that, you know, I can go off on tangents that other people don't really think of. And that's what people like about my writing. And also it means I'm not in competition with anyone else because nobody else would have thought of that tangent. So that's part of the reason why I do it. Also, you know, I'd say the real king of what you just described is George Saunders, the short story writer and novelist. He will pack, you know, an extraordinary novel into a paragraph over and over again. The example that just popped into my head is in the story he wrote called The Wave Maker Falters, which is about a guy who runs like one of those wave machines at a Lido. And he loses concentration and somebody dies in the mechanism of his wave machine. And to pay penance, he sneaks into that person's family every night and does chores. Like he deburs the dog or paints their fence just secretly in the middle of the night. Now, that could be a whole novel. And that comes and goes like in two sentences in that George Saunders book, which I thought was just, you know, so powerful to pack a whole idea into a paragraph. My producer, Sarah, said to me, "Things Fell Apart, season 2 is about to come out." And my producer, Sarah, said to me, "You know, episode 1 could have been a whole series. But we basically just, you know, ripped through it in one episode." Mm-hmm. And she's right. It could have been a whole series. But there is something nice about giving people a whole series in one episode.
There's a book, I think it's called Storyworthy, but I could be wrong on that. But the central message of the book is that you should live your life as if you're telling a story. So when you're making decisions about, you know, do I take this job or do I move here, you should just think back what would make the best story further on. And when I speak to someone like yourself, I get very inspired because I think maybe I should be a bit more like John and like try and experience all of these crazy stories and then I can write about them. What do you think of that message of just like picking life decisions based on what would make a good story?
It's funny. I think it reminded me of my friend Mike West when I lived in Manchester. He was in this band, the band from Del Monte. And he said to me, "You do realize, John, that the second time we met, you were already talking about old times." Like I was like creating a kind of mythology of our lives. Like, do you remember? So yeah, I think I do automatically do that. You know, isn't there a pop song about, you know, walking down the street, like imagining, you know, a commentator commenting on everything that you're doing, like, in a sort of excited. So I think I just do that. I sort of kind of create a sort of mythology of my otherwise, you know, of my actually far more banal life.
The last thing I wanted to touch on was, have there been any habits or ways of approaching things that have been helpful for you in your creative career? And one prompt, like, feel free to go any way you want to, but I've heard you talk a lot about the idea of just being resourceful as a mechanism or a huge competitive advantage in succeeding in creativity. But what's been helpful for you?
Yeah, hustle. Hustle. You know, at the beginning of this, we talked about how, you know, when I was starting out, you had to, you know, convince gatekeepers to give you a chance. And so right from the beginning, it's all a hustle. You have to hustle to convince people to talk to you. You have to like hustle to get access to things. You have to hustle to get your story published. Tireless hustle. Also, it helps if your entire self-worth is wrapped around your work, because then all you don't want to do is just have work all the time. I mean, well, you know, I love work. Like, I love to work. Nothing makes me happier than making a sentence that didn't work. It's like doing this, you know, I feel like I'm like a sort of puzzler, like one of those people who sits there doing 1,000-word jigsaws every day, but it happens to be story construction. And so it helps if you really want to do it, which leads me to another piece of advice I'd say, which is try always and do stories that you want to do, as opposed to stories that other people, you know, are encouraging you to do. Because I think you need, you know, it's such a long, desolate process. I think you need the wind behind your sails. And that happens when you've got a story that you're passionate about telling, that you really, you know, a mystery that you want to solve. Or whatever it is that spurs you on, go for that. Because as Roald Dahl said in his storytelling tips, you know, nobody's sitting there making sure you do the work. You have to be entirely self-motivated. So, you know, finding a story that you really want to tell, a mystery you want to solve, that helps a lot. And as I say, just, you know, I wouldn't say I've always been, you know, sometimes it's been a chore. Like, oh my God, you know, I've got to, you know, the sort of relentlessness of having to write every day, especially if you're doing like a weekly column, it can become a chore. But I should say that, you know, at this point in my life, I feel really lucky that I only work on things that I really want to work on. And that means I work all the time and really hard because I'm enjoying it.
What do you think? There's a guy called Jason Calacanis, who's a famous investor, and he does the All In podcast and This Week in Startups. But he has effectively built a very successful tech podcast, and his bit of advice was just be there in 10 years. That's it. If you're prolific and you're still there in 10 years, you're likely to have some kind of success, however you might measure that. What do you think of that thought of just being prolific and just staying in the game?
I think that's absolutely true. When you said that, a memory popped into my head, which is when I lived in London, when we lived in Highgate, my son went to the same school that Jonathan Ross's kids went to. And when George Clooney, you know, announced he was going to turn The Men Who Stay at Goats into a movie, Jonathan Ross, I can't remember whether I told Jonathan Ross or whether he'd heard, but he came up to me in the school playground and said, you know, you see, John, you stick around long enough, you know, something, you know. And it was a slightly passive-aggressive thing for him to say, because I've been at it for so many years. But he was right. You stick around. I think if you stick around long enough, look, if you quit, nothing's going to happen. You know, if you're not writing, then you're not writing. So I think it's true. I think if you stick around long enough, stuff will happen.
Perfect. All right, John, I will stop recording. Just as interesting backstory, John's book, The Psychopath Test, is the reason I went to med school wanting to become a psychiatrist. That didn't end up happening, but it's a great book. I recommend reading it. But I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please send it to someone who you think might find it interesting. That would be super, super helpful. See you in the next one.